Welcome to our podcast, Off Center. What is Off Center, you may ask? Off Center is the CNN News 18 series that maps the heart and mind of contemporary India. Each week, using the fine art of conversation, Anuradha Sengupta delves into the central issues of our times, piecing together the jigsaw puzzle of our collective morality, ethics, emotions, desires, and hopes.
This week, I'm talking to mythologist Devdutt Patnaik. The epics have a timeless appeal, don't they? They are stories of moral conflict, human frailty, ambition, love, heroism, straddled religious beliefs, cultural traditions, and popular storytelling. Devdutt Patnaik, a doctor by training, is one of India's most popular mythologists. His books based on these epics are bestsellers. As India celebrates its biggest festival, Diwali, I want Devdutt to explain the significance of Diwali. I'm particularly keen to understand also why Maryada Purushottam, the god-king Ram, is the ideal icon for Hindu political parties. It's a bright sunny morning. I'm at Devdutt's large apartment in Mumbai. We're sitting cross-legged on the floor on a vibrant orange-hued carpet. There are books everywhere. Even the wall has framed covers of his books. We are celebrating Diwali. Yes. What does Diwali symbolize?
Prosperity, abundance, affluence. Mm. So it is a celebration which stretches over several days. It is the day when Lakshmi comes into your life. Mm. So the festivals are about, so it begins with Naraka Chaturdashi, the killing of the demon. Mm. Then you will have the festival of, you have Trayodashi, the 13th day when metal is being worshipped. You have festivals on the 15th day when the ocean was churned and Lakshmi emerges. So Lakshmi is worshipped on the new moon night. People play gambling. Why gambling are we gambling? Because gambling is a game of luck and skill. If you have luck, you will win no matter what. And if you have skill, even if you don't have luck, you can turn the tables around, which is how business is, right? A combination of luck and skill. So you are taught that. The traders in India would play gambling and dice games on that night, and Lakshmi is being worshipped. Fortune comes to he who is skilled or lucky, one of the two.
Right.
So that's what is done.
And so what is the connection with Ram's return to Ayodhya?
So you see, India has layers and layers of tradition. Prosperity in India was associated with Ram Rajya. Ram Rajya is prosperous. So Diwali is the celebration of Ram. When Ram came back, prosperity came back. He brought Lakshmi with her. He liberated Sita, who is Lakshmi, from Lanka and brought her back to Ayodhya. She had left Ayodhya along with him.
Yeah.
So the story is she is prosperity. She is Sita. She is the furrow. She is the agricultural goddess.
I'm going to center this conversation about Ram because a lot of conversation today is about Ram. And you said Ram Rajya is about prosperity.
Yes.
Why is Ram such a figure of reverence for many, many Hindus? And why does Ram and the epic, the Ramayana, have such a strong grip over large parts of South Asia?
Not just Ram. Even Shiva is across this area. Hmm. So is Shakti, the goddess. Hmm. So is Vishnu. Hmm. So is Krishna. Hmm. So the fact is all these traditions exist. Today, Ram has become important because it has become the Ishta Devata, the central deity of the political parties.
Yeah.
So if they have chosen to pick one idea over because, you see,
why the idea of Ram? What is it about the, Maryada Purushottam, the rule, the protector of rules or the follower of rules that is so attractive?
For me, there is a great similarity between the Abrahamic model of thinking and Ramayana, and the Greek model of thinking is very aligned to Krishna. You know, the Greek and Western thought is a combination of Abrahamic thought and Greek thought. India has adopted both. We can take both. The West can take only one at a time. We can take both simultaneously. Therefore, Ram and Krishna. And then you have Shiva who rejects both, which is no rules, out of the box, doesn't care for the system. So you have all three. And India is a combination of Ram, Krishna and Shiva. Three different ways of looking at the world. That a political party has chosen only one of them reveals that they are not willing to see the larger narrative of India. That's their choice. We all take choices. Mm-hmm. But it's also because the rule following Ram sounds very upright. But it's a very simple understanding of Ramayana. Ramayana is one of the most complex works ever written. Every time I write, I've written 3 books on Ramayana. Mm-hmm. And I can write 4 and 5 and 6 mm-hmm. because you're nourished by the epic and its grandeur. It's one of the most, every time you read Ramayana, when you're unhappy, you read the Ramayana and you are charged with life.
No, what is it? What is so exciting for you about the Ramayana? What is it about this story and this narrative that charges you, that nourishes you?
See, Ramayana, the clue of Ramayana is when it starts writing, the poet starts writing about it when he sees 2 birds flying, you know, cruncha birds, you can call it love birds, actually, cranes. Mm. They're flying in the air and the hunter shoots one of them and that one dies and the other one keeps crying and crying. Mm. The male bird is killed and the female bird keeps crying. Mm. This is the beginning of the Ramayana, and that's when Valmiki sees and curses the hunter, and the curse comes out in the form of poetry. Mm. And he says, oh, this is poetry. That's why it's called Adikavya. But this model of a hunter killing the bird and the female bird crying is a recurring theme in the Ramayana. Mandodari crying when Ravana is killed. Tara crying when Vali is killed. And who is the killer? Ram. And suddenly you are being told, you too shall face the same suffering. And therefore Ram and Sita have this very tragic relationship. Deeply in love, but never allowed to be together. Because society almost conspires against them. You know, they're separated constantly. Ravana separates them. And the people of Ayodhya separate them, the gossip. So the separation, this Karuna Ras, which is the most powerful Ras of this great king. You know, Ramayana is not the story of a husband or a child or a son. It is a story of a king. Who is the great king? The one who will even abandon his innocent wife very unfairly because his people are gossiping about her. That's the ideal king. My personal happiness I will destroy, even if it's unfair, unjust, for the sake of my people.
The thing is that I grew up in a feminist household, and when you look at the Ramayana and Ram, especially through that lens, he comes up lacking, isn't it?
Well, no, see, you know, Ramayana is...
I mean, Sita, let's say Ram Rajya, which is supposed to be about prosperity and therefore everyone's well-being, was not very kind to Sita and by extension to women?
It's how you see the narrative. Mm. You know, for example, if I use consent as a framework, the Bible doesn't come across very well.
Mm. No, I'm not talking about this vis-a-vis anything else.
You see, it's important to do that because you see, somewhere along the line, Indians are very critical of their own traditions without realizing globally we live in a patriarchal system.
Yeah.
That being said, Ramayana is about choice. Mm. Sita makes 5 choices in the Ramayana. She makes all independent decisions. Her decisions are always independent. Ram is not independent at all. He is bound by his kula, his family. He is within the structure. Mm-hmm. He is the eldest son of the royal family who cannot make choices. Mm-hmm. So Ram makes not a single choice in the entire Ramayana. Everything is pre-decided for him. You are the eldest son, you're supposed to do this. You are the king, you're supposed to do this. It's always supposed to do. And Ram is submitting. Sita refuses to submit to anything. So it's the highly feminist document for me. Mm. Like, I mean, I've written a children's book. You know, I wrote a children's book with a girl who chose just so that people see. First, the only choice she doesn't make is she doesn't select the husband. Because he breaks the bow and he's given the wife. No choice. But then she makes choices. Husband tells her, stay in the family house, I'm going to the forest. She says, no, I will come with you. And she argues it brilliantly. So here you have a woman who makes choices. She's told, stay within the Lakshman Rekha. She says, no, I will cross it because there's a hungry man to be fed. That is more important than my security. Look at this. A woman of substance. Hanuman comes and says, jump on my back, I'll take you back to Ram. She says, no, I will stay back. Let my husband redeem himself in the eyes of his people that he couldn't protect me. Look at this. She's thinking about his honor. She could have easily run away. She's choosing. So
but
every
she's
time
choosing in a way that the man is first and the man's well-being is paramount, isn't
See,
it?
When we talk about choice, we can't then say what choices she must make. This is the character who's making choices. Because we want to make this a anti-feminist book, anything which I even remotely suggest feminism, we shall attack. So that's an agenda-based analysis.
The treatment of Sita in the book, which is Ram abandoning her because of Log Kya Kahenge, the oldest thing in the world. None of this is a problem.
So for me, the problem is the tragedy of a man who is not allowed to make choices. That's the tragedy. He can't make choices. He's being told this is the rule, you have to follow the rule. What is feminism? It is about the power equation between men and women. It is not about ill treatment of men and women. It's about how is power being transmitted. Mm. When I read the Ramayana, I see a very powerful woman called Sita.
And you see a weak man called Ram?
No, I see a trapped man. A trapped man. He is trapped in patriarchy. Because see, as a king, we assume a king can make choices. This is our assumption. Mm. In a traditional Varanashrama dharma, you are not allowed to make choices. Mm. Ram is the eldest son of a royal family. Krishna is the youngest son of a cowherd family. Mm. They are two different contexts. They cannot behave the same. Mm.
So again, why is it that Ram, who is trapped by society, by the circumstances, who follows the rules, why is he the ideal man for a lot of right-wing thinking in this country? Why is he the ideal?
It's a right wing for everybody. He's not just right wing, also left wing, because he's a man of integrity. Mm. You, whether you're left or right or north or south or center, wherever you are, you want to respect a man with integrity. Mm. With Ram, there is no doubt. Mm. He is what he is, what he is. He's predictable. Mm. You know exactly how he's going to behave. There are no, like Krishna is, you don't know where he stands. Mm. He's smiling and flirting and fighting wars, and they're shown with Shiva doesn't care. Mm. He's like laughing away to glory, thinking everything you do is stupid. Mm. So you have these three characters. With Ram, there's complete predictability. That's why he's called the embodiment of Dharma. For the people, as a man, as a subject, as you and I, we want someone whom we can trust. Mm. We are always looking for someone who can. He's Raja Ram is worshipped. Pati Ram is not worshipped. Putra Ram is not worshipped. Raja Ram is worshipped. Mm. The story of a king who has to kill and be responsible for the wailing of the widow and therefore kills his own self, his own personal happiness for the sake of the people. So it's a tragic story. It's full of karuna. Ram doesn't benefit from being a king.
You're very popular, your books, your columns, your TV shows. What is it? Would you be able to distill what is it that people find from these myths?
They're looking for answers to life. You know, we're looking for answers to life. That's why we are drawn to mythology. In India, we have always looked at mythology, never history. Mm. Because history is of the past. It's not relevant today. Mm. But mythology is eternally relevant, always relevant. Mm. So it deals with psychological truths. It doesn't deal with material truths. It deals with psychological truths. And we are looking for those psychological truth answers. Therefore, I'm drawn to mythology. Of course, you know, mythology can be classified into two groups. One where the author is putting his own point of view and using mythology as a tool to package it. Mm. The other is where you are analyzing the stories and trying to figure out what have been they telling over the years, which is the school of thought I belong to. Mm. Where I'm trying to figure out what does Shiva mean? It's not what I feel, it's what it doesn't mean in the context of Ram and Krishna and Devi. And so for me, it's a jigsaw puzzle that I'm trying to solve. What are these many gods telling? You know, that's what I do when I'm doing Greek mythology or Abrahamic mythology. Mm. What are they revealing about a worldview? And I think I share that with people, and that has made it popular because I think people are also enjoying the process by which I do it.
Do you find, as a mythologist, as someone who you know, you're nourished by these stories, these universal myths in a sense, which no matter how much time passes, you will see playing out again, perhaps in everyday lives of everyday people. Do you find that you're walking on eggshells because of the appropriation of mythology by politics?
You see, everybody appropriates myths. For example, I have seen Western scholars and scholars in Indian universities appropriate myths to humiliate India. Mm. Oh, your culture is, we are patriarchal, we are these horrible, Indians love to hate themselves. Mm. You see them appropriated by NRIs who transform this into something else. You know, there's so much of passport shame that some will say India is the most glorious country in the world, or they'll go to the other extreme, India is the worst country in the world. Mm. It's appropriated by politicians, by scholars. Everybody appropriates it for their own thing.
Yeah.
For them, Ram is a convenient tool for whatever they want, the way they use and abuse everything.
Did you hear about the announcement of a Ram museum in Ayodhya with 250 crores for it?
Good for
and
it.
This is part of a a plan to develop spiritual and pilgrim pilgrimage tourism across the country.
I think rather enough Ram temples and Ram for me, Ram is always in a temple, not in a museum. Museum mein khandar rakhte hai. You keep dead things in the museum. Mm. You keep mummies and Egyptian mummies and old statues. Mm. God is not kept in a museum. Ram is God. He has to be in a temple.
Are you then saying that you need the temple in Ayodhya?
Everywhere. Your temple is in your heart. There is Ram. You don't need a physical temple. Temple is there everywhere. It has to bring joy. If the temple has to be built in Ayodhya, it has to bring joy. If it is not bringing joy, don't build it. One day it'll happen. We have infinity to wait for. What's the hurry? What's this hurry that in my lifetime I will solve all problems of India? That's the arrogance and lack of faith in karma. Tumhare bhagya mein likha hai, is it in your karma? It will happen. Even Ram could not change his fate. He had to be separated from his wife. You see, karma is so powerful. In Ramayana, how do they show karma? You cut the nose of Surpanakha. A woman's nose is cut. You're talking about a feminist document. After that, Ram doesn't have a moment of joy. And he also didn't do it. His brother did it. Who's from that moment on, there is no joy in Ram's life. Separation from Sita, war, comeback, public gossip, separation. That's karma. That's how karma is being taught in Ramayana. But we are not told that. There is God gracefully accepting his karma, never angry with Kaikeyi or Surpanakha or Ravan, bowing to Ravan, even after killing him and fighting, he's separated. Hota hai life mein. This kind of positivity, separating Sita, not able to face her when he's parting, because he knows that he will not be able to bear the separation. Ram only weeps when he's separated with Sita, otherwise he never weeps. He doesn't let anyone, he could have remarried. He doesn't remarry. It's Ekam Patni Vrata Ram. See, this is Ram. This is beautiful Ram.
And he doesn't need a museum.
He doesn't. Oh, please, no. He's Sanatan. Sanatan ko aap kaise rakh sakte ho sangrahale mein? It's timeless. Bhagwan hai wo.
Karwa Chauth was just celebrated recently, and I saw many women very defensive that they were practicing it or they were observing it rather. And then there were many people who were, there was this meme, don't feed the patriarchy by practicing this. How does an individual come to terms with this conflict? Because let's face it, all religions, and this is not about Hinduism, all religions are hugely patriarchal, you don't deny that. And yet at the same time, there's a question of individual choice, there's a sense of community, there's a sense of belonging. How do you balance these two?
In all these conversations, what is being missed? Everybody wants to control the other. Why are you selling your idea? So if I am doing Karwa Chauth, why are you selling me the idea of not doing it or doing it? Either way. This desire to sell, everybody's become a missionary of something. We are becoming missionaries because we want to change the world, convert the world to our needs. We all want to save other people. I think that is it. Our desire to dominate and domesticate the other. This is at the heart of these Facebook things. Because why are you selling it? I've always asked this. Why this missionary zeal of converting people into pro or anti Karwa Chauth camps? Why can't people just be?
Do you think after 2014, when we had a BJP-led government, which is a Hindu party, do you think that has polarized society even more? Because what has happened is that their politics is using mythology and religion to get an ideological basis for their
goals. Every political party has an ideological base. Every political party. Some have a religious, some... Every party favors some form of casteism or the other. They all have vote banks. They all follow different religious narratives. Some of the earlier political parties supported some of the most primitive practices of Muslim communities, which are in other Muslim countries have been abandoned.
Correct.
They've been abandoned. Yeah. Modern Muslims across the world, my friends and around the world, are saying that why do Indians still follow these practices which are not practiced in, in Turkey, for example, in very modern countries. So we have sort of indulged this kind of a covert religiosity in the name of secularism, covert casteism in the name of secularism.
In February, you wrote in the Mumbai Mirror about a ritual cleansing. You titled the article, A Ritual Cleansing. And it began by saying, can a woman be a muezzin and call the faithful to gather at the Jama Masjid to pray? Can India have a female archbishop? Can an openly gay man be allowed to lead the Akal Takht? Can a Dalit be a priest in a temple at Kanchipuram, Tamil Nadu? Can a European be allowed to enter the Jagannath temple in Puri, Odisha? Can, it goes on about a ritual cleansing and reforms. Now, I understood what you set out to ask, but I must admit that I'm not sure what you said was the solution.
The fact is, we are talking about, you know, equality, but we don't understand that equality eventually leads to homogeneity.
Mm.
Homogeneity means lack of diversity. So right. Diversity and equality are the opposites of each other.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And people don't understand. We think equality and diversity are one and the same thing. They're the complete opposites of each other. Hinduism is based on diversity, not equality. Christianity is based on equality, not diversity.
Mm.
These are fundamental, highly complex intellectual ideas that have not been understood. So we are just making these very casual, superficial claims.
Mm.
A religion that is based on diversity cannot be seen through the paradigm of equality. A religion that believes there can only be one God and therefore will not even allow another. So only what gender has that God? Why do you use the male pronoun? Why not the female pronoun? Why is that not part of the feminist discourse?
Mm.
Because it doesn't get you attention of the media. I mean, that's a cynical way of looking at it. So I always say that, wait a minute, you can't just bulldoze your way into creating a wonderful world. You have to take people along, and these are complex, slow processes.
Mm.
100 years ago, many of these temples would not let certain communities enter the temple.
Mm.
Today they do. There is a change. Not as fast and as much as we want it to be, but there is.
Mm.
We believe the world is always changing. That is Hindu philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, Jain philosophy. The world is continuously changing.
Mm.
The West doesn't believe in that. Therefore, they need revolutions. So this belief in revolution is a Western thought which believes the world is static and then there's a revolution and change happens.
Did you feel sympathetic to women wanting to get into these temples?
No.
Because I remember saying to Trupti, I said, but what is the big deal? Don't go to a God who doesn't want you.
No, so see, the thing
and
is...
And she was like, but you don't understand. Religion is such a starting point of community, of identity and a lot of things. So this becomes the starting point or a stepping stone to a lot of other rights that we would like to claim and should claim but can't.
I don't feel sympathetic. In life, you don't get everything. There are many places I am not allowed to enter. There are many Hindu temples men are not allowed to enter.
Mm.
I can't do Karwa Chauth.
Mm.
Should I now get upset by that because only women are doing Karwa Chauth? No, it's my mother used to do rituals which I couldn't. You know,
so you're saying there was no need to storm the temples for women?
I think this was like storming of the Bastille. We're just giving ourselves... We are constructing villains so that we can be heroes. And that's a very clever model that is used by politicians and activists.
If you wanted to pray and you were not allowed to enter a temple, how should that woman
look at the way
it?
You framed the question. How... If I were to say the question is manipulative...
Hmm.
Because you're saying, if I want to pray, how should I enter a temple?
Mm.
The assumption here is that God inside the temple does not have gender and sexuality. But Hindu gods have gender and sexuality.
Of course.
And a celibate God
yeah.
is saying, I don't want women around. And you're saying, no, I want to see you.
Mm.
But that's a celibate
but
God.
But then that's feeding into another argument that you make so frequently, which is that of Hinduism, which is that, you know, the rejection of women is also got misogyny embedded in it.
But
no?
this is
and
not misogyny. So you're saying that every celibate man is misogynist?
No, but are you saying that every celibate man will give up his celibacy because he just
Most
sees
of the
a
gurus
woman?
Will not meet women. Most gurus, women are not allowed to come around them because they're celibate men.
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying celibate men are misogynist?
No, but are you then also saying that if a woman goes around and goes near a celibate man, he will give up his celibacy immediately? Is it so tenuous, this desire to be celibate?
You're underestimating the power of women. Because I don't have faith in the power of men. But you're underestimating the power of women. But that's their belief. That's belief, right? Belief is not rational. There are hundreds of temples in India where women are allowed. There is one temple which you have never heard of. It was 20 years ago, nobody knew of Shani Shingnapur. Ayyappa, 100 years ago, only the Malayalis would go there, a small portion of the
people.
Now you have made it like God. Gods have sexuality. Gods are married.
Yeah.
In church, the God, if you say God, who's God's wife? Who's Mrs. God? You have this controversy, you know, when Dan Brown wrote a book suggesting that Jesus was married.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea that Jesus could have a wife was unacceptable.
Mm.
And here you have a problem because one celibate God is saying that, you know, women...
Stay away. Stay away.
Not all women. Not all women. Because there's a belief.
My concern is that while I buy the context, you know, that there is context, there's nuance, there are details, there's belief, there's faith, you also need to change so that larger numbers of people can have a more just place to be in, isn't it? A more prosperous way to be.
And if you then believe in justice, yes. I don't believe in justice. I believe justice is a Greek mythic concept, a goddess called Dike. Mm-hmm. And please remember, the Greeks also believed in an unequal aristocratic world.
Yeah,
they had special heavens for heroes.
Yeah.
They had, you know, reservation system. If you're a child of a god, you'll go to a special heaven. Mm. So the word justice comes from a culture which believed in inequality. Christianity brought the idea of equality, and therefore equality became justice. So today we are talking about diversity and saying in a diverse world there should be justice. But we want a uniform civil code. These are complicated ideas. People are not. The moment you bring uniformity, you bring homogeneity. Mm-hmm. Homogeneity means lack of heterogeneity, which means lack of diversity.
But are you then saying that if you have to trade off between more equity, not equality, more equity and a greater prosperity and a greater sense of fairness for most people, and if that means that you give up,
you'll have to give up a lot of things.
Diversity.
Are you willing? Karma, no? Karma is, what are you willing to give up? You want the perfect Ram? Hmm. This is the great Ram. He also has to give up his beloved, innocent Sita. Hmm. There's no free lunch. You cut the nose of Surpanakha, there's unhappiness forever. You want Ram Rajya? Where's Sita?
So the uniform civil code will,
what is the price of it? We don't know. What is the price? What is the negative side of it? We don't know. It sounds like a very great idea. Mm. What are the consequences? Mm. Communities will have to give up their power to the state. Mm. That is what the fight is about. Community is less important. State is most important. Mm. Is it okay? Are you willing to pay the price? Now that will come at a price, because how many of them will allow gay marriage? Will the Uniform Civil Code allow gay marriage? This Uniform Civil Code, our government has not even acknowledged.
You're
talking about justice.
No, but
we don't live
in
a just society.
No, of course not. And of course not. But the point is that, like you mentioned, you know, gay rights and gay marriage and aspirations, women are, you know, I'm saying there are all these different fights that are going on, right?
So, you know, the thing is, that's what, niyat kya hai? Why are you doing it?
As usual, a pleasure talking, and happy Diwali.
Happy Diwali.
Watch out for our next podcast of Off Center on the weekend.